It's Tuesday, April 19, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. We are accustomed at this time of the year to looking at darkening skies and threatening weather, but across the United States, between Friday and Sunday, there was an outbreak of extreme weather that has led to at least 43 deaths and a recount of approximately at least 36 tornadoes that set down between Oklahoma and North Carolina and Virginia over that three-day period. This is a reminder to us, isn't it, of the way that nature can sometimes turn. The sky can be blue, and just a few hours later, you can have a tornadic system that moves into the area. One of the things that often comes to mind when we consider this kind of a disaster, of a weather outbreak, is that the weather can sometimes have giant impacts, with nature releasing all of its fury in a hurricane like Katrina that hit New Orleans and literally changed history. Sometimes history can come in a more local way, and with these outbreaks of severe weather, well, sometimes one community is hit when another is spared, or for that matter, even one neighborhood or one home is hit and others are spared. But the human toll is still very significant. 43 deaths, a number of churches and communities and schools destroyed. You know, back in the 1970s, there were outbreaks of severe weather. Some of them included storm systems with over 100 tornadoes and something like 330 deaths. But we don't remember them very well. You know, one of the things that perhaps we ought to think about when we consider this is the fragility of human memory. When you consider what's going on in Japan in the aftermath of its triple natural disaster, and then as the nuclear disaster there continues to unfold, what kind of scale does it take to get and to maintain our imagination? There were days just recently when every single news report had to begin with Japan and the toll of the deaths there. And now, already, other things have intervened. You know, as fragile and frail human beings, one of the markers of our fragility and of our finitude is the fact that we can't even keep our attention focused very long, even when there is a disaster. Let's pray for the folks from Oklahoma to Virginia whose lives have been literally changed, and some of them moved to grieving of the death of loved ones. And let's remember that in a fallen world, even the weather systems with their violence demonstrate the catastrophic effects of sin in the cosmos that God has made. In Washington, of course, a great deal of the discussion is now pointed towards the debate over the budget to come, and of course the raising of the debt ceiling. And much of this is a debate about whether there should be a debate. Some of it is a debate that is frankly nothing more than public relations. It's just the opportunity for politicians, statesmen, and public officials to get behind a microphone and to say what they think the voters want to hear. Well, I'm indebted to the fact that the Week in Review section of Sunday's New York Times actually had a very important article that brought a bit of clarity to this discussion. Richard W. Stevenson, writing an article entitled "The Budget Debate Revealed," goes on to say that finally, at last, this is the debate that the United States has been putting off for some time. He says this: "The battle ahead is a big one and goes to the very questions about the role of government." He's quoting there G. William Hoagland, a former Republican staff director of the Senate Budget Committee. Mr. Hoagland went on to say this is going to be a very fundamental clash of ideologies. Then Stevenson explains the Democratic and Republican parties have their own internal tensions to address as the debate goes forward in Congress and on the presidential campaign trail. But in its early stages, at least, it's liberals who are on the defensive. Well, as the New York Times gives this coverage, and its Week in Review section, you'll remember, is its in-depth editorial and analysis section of Sunday's newspaper, it really does offer some clarity here that's important. For instance, it goes to President Obama's address last Wednesday at George Washington University and cites the fact that he defended and defined patriotism as a shared sense of responsibility for the vulnerable and less fortunate. The president said that basic standards of security for the elderly and the poor and government investment in a more prosperous future can not only coexist with the tradition of what he called rugged individualists with a healthy skepticism of too much government, but, as Mr. Stevenson says, the president also argued that this is a vital part of what makes America exceptional. On the other hand, the president finds himself in a position that most Democrats in general, and more liberal Democrats in particular, do not want to find themselves facing. He's having to agree with the Republicans that significant cuts are going to have to be made, that the current budgetary structure of the United States in terms of expenditures and income is unsustainable. Now, one of the things we're going to have to watch is that both parties, coming at this with their own ideological conceptions and pre-commitments of what's at stake, are also going to be tempted to make the numbers dance in order to prove their point. There's another part of this article that's very important, and what makes this section important is that it is not a Republican in this case who's speaking, but rather William Galston, who was a domestic policy aide to President Bill Clinton. He's now with the Brookings Institution, and he said that Mr. Ryan, that is Congressman Ryan, deserves credit for having brought about a new discussion level, as Paul Ryan, representative, brought a genuine contribution in terms of an actual budget that supposedly would eventually balance the U.S. budget. He credited Mr. Ryan with this, but he stopped short of giving him a thumbs up on it. He said instead that the Republican Party is now bound by what he described as an increasingly rigid anti-tax posture, which first took root in the 1970s, a posture that has put greater and greater pressure on budgets and on the social programs they support. Speaking of the Ryan budget, Mr. Galston said, it represents the first serious effort to begin to bring Republicans' social policy commitments in line with their fiscal and tax commitments. But it's the next statement that I found particularly profound. Mr. Galston said the Democrats, too, faced a credibility test. Quote, they have held fast to the security programs in place since the 1930s, but without being able to successfully challenge the anti-tax orthodoxy. The problem the Democrats have is that they can no longer say with a straight face that raising taxes on the wealthy is going to enable them to pay over the next generation for the programs they cherish. So what do they do? End quote. Well, that's the kind of analysis that a major newspaper like the New York Times can give that brings a great deal of clarity to the discussion that is about to ensue. We need to look at this and recognize that indeed we have not only two rival budgets at stake here, but two rival understandings of the function of government, of what government should do and how these things should be paid for. And as Mr. Galston makes very clear, both parties are now in a bind. Both parties are going to have to come clean with the American people if this is going to be an actual debate over what matters. We're going to have to talk about what government should do, and once there's a consensus on that point, we're going to talk about how the government will gain the funds in order to accomplish that. You know, this is pretty much what the average family has to do on a monthly basis. This is what the federal government has resisted doing since the 1930s. And as the recent experience of Greece, Portugal, Spain, and other nations now makes clear, it is an excruciatingly difficult process. Why? Well, because so many of these programs are already very much in place. And very difficult to change. Speaking of budgets, here's something that might have escaped your attention. The Philadelphia Orchestra has declared bankruptcy. That vote came on Saturday night as the board of the Philadelphia Orchestra, one of the nation's most famous orchestras, one of the leading orchestras in the world, has declared bankruptcy. It's coming up even as it has a budget of about $46 million a year. It's running short about $5 million a year. And it sees no way to close that. By the way, and another $46 million is a figure in terms of the pensions for musicians that it basically now, given its budget, cannot pay. Now, you look at this and you recognize that something very significant is taking place here. We're talking about a cultural artifact that literally is priceless just in terms of the money involved. How do you put a price on a symphony orchestra? How do you put a price or a quantitative value upon classical music? But this is a nation that no longer actually pays much attention to classical music. Orchestras, which were once thoroughly supported by communities, now find themselves supported, if at all, then by a very thin margin. And if you want to know where we are in terms of music, as one recent journal pointed out, there are about 100 different classifications in record stores, and by the way, that's an anachronism of sorts, but in music stores and online sources such as iTunes. But 1,000 years, an entire millennia of art music, and a millennium, is now reduced to the designation classical music. So the music of the last 10 years, about 100 different subgroups. The music of the last 1,000 years, just one word, classical. That's why these orchestras are declaring bankruptcy. You better be careful what you say out there. If you don't say something nice, just don't say anything at all. That was my grandmother's advice. If you can't say something nice, you ought not to go on Twitter. Evidently, that's the advice coming from celebrity publicists. Very interesting article that appeared over the weekend as Laura Holson reports that many publicists for celebrities are now wishing they could disconnect their celebrities from their cell phones and their Twitter accounts. So there have been some very recent disasters. The rapper Chris Brown, he and his publicist parted ways on March the 22nd, the very same day Mr. Brown shattered the window of a dressing room during a recent tirade at Good Morning America. Those pictures were quickly posted online. And then there are those who on Twitter have said things that they must now wish they could take back. And yet once it's posted, well, there it goes. This new dynamic gives our clients many new opportunities to screw up. That was said by Alan Meyer, a crisis management and corporate public relations advisor at the group known as 42 West in Los Angeles. In other words, what many of these publicists most fear is their client with a cell phone or with their thumbs active on Twitter or Facebook or some other form of digital media. Stephen Honig, who is the publicist who works for one of these celebrities, said, quote, "The margin of error is slim when you go directly to the public. One comment can become a fiasco in 10 seconds. You know, that is a pretty apt description of our contemporary cultural context with digital media. And quite frankly, it's not only Hollywood celebrities who need to have this word, but it's also all the rest of us who are now involved in social media and who have a presence online. You know, that advice from my grandmother, and you probably heard it from yours as well, is exactly right. If you can't say something nice, you probably ought to say nothing at all. Once it's out there in the Twitterverse, it's out there, folks. It's not coming back. Well, speaking of out there not coming back, how about the news report about the finding of the first homosexual caveman? No joke. If you heard this, last week it was reported that in the Czech Republic, in a suburb of Prague, they found a tomb of a corded ware culture victim. That is someone who died in, as a part of the corded ware culture, something a culture you probably didn't even know existed before. That's designated as a culture that began in the late Stone Age and culminated in the Bronze Age. Well, they found a tomb, and this is what they say. You find, this is a tomb of a man who was found with his head pointing eastward, surrounded by domestic jugs. And as this report in the Telegraph of London says, these were rituals only previously seen in female graves. Lead archaeologist Camilla Rosikova-Vesanova said, quote, "From history and ethnology, we know that people from this period took funeral rites very seriously, so it is highly unlikely that this positioning was a mistake," end quote. Far more likely, she said, is that he was a man with a different sexual orientation, homosexual or transsexual. And thus came the news reports that went international almost immediately about the finding of the first gay or homosexual caveman. It was explained that men in this culture would traditionally be buried facing the other direction, and they'd be buried with artifacts that would include weapons, hammers, and flint knives, as well as portions of food to accompany them to the other side. It is women who were buried with artifacts including jugs facing the opposite direction as men, and this was a man who was found facing the wrong direction in his death, and he was found having the wrong stuff in his tomb. No weapons, a jug. Well, as the archaeologist said, quote, "This latter discovery led us to believe the man was probably homosexual or transsexual," end quote. This is the kind of news that instantly goes around the world because it combines, as well, kind of our interest in cavemen now with the current fanatical interest in sexual orientation. But do you remember the argument being made by the gay rights activists? They're the ones who've been arguing for the last 20 years that it is improper to read sexual orientation onto previous cultures. They're the ones who are arguing that the very idea of sexual orientation is an essentially modern idea. Why, the liberal biblical scholars who say we can ignore Paul on homosexuality use the very argument that Paul didn't know anything about sexual orientation, and now they're trying to read their modern conceptions of sexual orientation now back onto a caveman, which they're dating to approximately 5,000 years ago. Well, here's the good news. The archaeological community is not buying this. You know, when these gay rights activists and their ideologues try to influence something like even the archaeologists who were investigating caves in a suburb of Prague, well, the good news is there are at least some scientists out there who say, you know, there could be another explanation. This could have nothing to do with this caveman being gay at all. Maybe this is just a man who liked pottery. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.